Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Now You Know, talk radio where you get to ask the questions. Call us now at 877-NYK-RADIO. That's 877-695-7234. And now, Ann Mitchell.
Welcome to this very special edition of Monday Night Radio. I am so very pleased to be able to introduce our first guest, and I will do so in just a moment. But first, I want to talk a little bit to you parents in particular out there, everyone out there, but especially parents or those who at some point will be a parent. The decision to whether to vaccinate your child or not, or which vaccinations to let them have, is a deeply personal decision. There's a great deal of information out there, and some of it is misinformation, but more of it is just a confusion of information. When I had my first child, who, let's just say she's an adult now planning a wedding, I won't reveal her age, but when I had my first child quite a while ago, there was never a question but that you would always immunize your child, you would do whatever the pediatrician said, and everything would hopefully turn out well. But now things really are quite muddled, and in part that seems to be due to the profusion of immunizations that we are told to give our children. My son, who is considerably younger than my daughter, had we given him the full course of immunizations, he would have had dozens, literally dozens of different types of vaccinations by the time he was just 2 years old. We electively immunize, which means that we immunize in the instances that we feel it to be very important and urgent, but we don't give him all the immunizations, and I'll give you an example. When I was a child, when my daughter was a child, there was not a vaccination for chickenpox. Kids just got it. Everyone gets it. Now you're told you should vaccinate against chickenpox. Now, I don't know how my guest feels about the chickenpox vaccine, but I can tell you that we chose not to have our son immunized for chickenpox, and in fact, we went out of our way to ensure that he got them naturally, which, as we understand it, confers a much better lifelong immunity. In any event, the point is that for every family, they need to make their own immunization decisions, weighing what they feel the risks may be, what the benefits may be, how they feel about the importance of what's known as herd immunity, which means that because you vaccinate your child and the child next to them won't be at risk because your child won't be a carrier. All very personal decisions. Our guest is Dr. Andrew Wakefield. He is a British doctor, a researcher, who published a paper several years ago with many colleagues having to do with, and again, if I get this wrong, Dr. Wakefield, as soon as I bring you on, please correct me, but having to do with the study of about a dozen of their patients who they noticed had some things in common having to do with their gastrointestinal functions and noting that they had all seemed to decline in some way or other following vaccinations. And so this paper suggested that perhaps it would make sense to look into that and see if there was something there. And what followed can only be described as a firestorm. And if you have ever looked into the issue of immunizations for any reason, and whether you're for, against, unsure, I'm sure that our guest is known to you at least by name. So without further ado, let me bring on Dr. Wakefield. Hello, are you there?
I am indeed.
Good evening. Thank you so very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Now, before we get into talking at all about really anything, let me just tell everyone out there, if you have questions or comments for Dr. Wakefield, the call-in number, as always, is 866-MONDAY-6. You can also send us a message by Twitter at Monday Radio, or email your question to comments at mondaynightradio.com. We will try to get to all callers, but people are already lighting up the switchboard, and so just please be patient, and we will do the best that we can. Dr. Wakefield, let's just cut right to the chase. As I understand it, there was a paper that was published with your name along with several of your colleagues in The Lancet several years ago. And that paper was what's known as a case study, meaning you were simply reporting on observations you and your colleagues had made with respect to some of your patients. This was not, in fact, research or a research paper. Is that correct?
That is correct. It was a clinical observation reporting the parents' story, what they felt had happened to their child, and the clinical findings, what was discovered on colonoscopy and blood tests. That's correct.
Okay, and what were those things that the parents were reporting, and what were the findings? What was the impetus to look at all of the totality of those cases and what you were seeing that caused you and your colleagues to think, you know, we should bring this to the attention of people just to see if it merits further investigation?
Well, it began where all medicine should begin, and that's with the parent's story in this case, or the patient's story. What had actually happened, and what was our duty to act upon the parent's story to find out whether it had merit or not. And the children that were referred to us, the parents said, my child was developing normally, and then they regressed into autism. In 8 of the 12 children, that regression started immediately after an MMR vaccine, a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. The child had been developing entirely normally before, was indistinguishable from their peers, and then suddenly lost skills. They lost eye contact, speech, language. They didn't interact with their siblings anymore. They were not interested in playing. And sometimes they would scream inconsolably, waking all night long. It was a terrible situation. They eventually were diagnosed with atypical or regressive autism. And the other problem that they had was they had intestinal symptoms, which were very severe. The first mother reported diarrhea up to 12 times a day in her child, with bloating of the child's abdomen and clearly in pain, but the child had lost the ability to express that, to say they were in pain, and so they would be hitting their head against a wall or injuring themselves in an attempt to get away from it. And the doctors that they'd seen had said, this is just part of autism. Well, no, it's not, actually. This child was clearly physically unwell and needed to be investigated properly. And so with my colleagues, including the world's leading pediatric gastroenterologists, we decided to take this very seriously and investigate these children, as was our duty as physicians. And that's what we did, and lo and behold, the parents were absolutely right. The children had a novel and previously undescribed bowel disease and intestinal inflammation. It was very interesting because when we treated that, as you would treat Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis with anti-inflammatory medication, then not only did the bowel symptoms, the intestinal symptoms improve, the diarrhea got better, for example, the pain went away, but also the autistic symptoms got better. The child would start talking or laughing or enjoying life for the first time. And that was the beginning of a very, very interesting journey.
Now, your background is actually as a gastroenterologist or a specialist in gastroenterology in children, I believe. Is that correct?
Well, my interest is, my expertise is in inflammatory bowel disease in adults and children, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. So I was the sort of the generalist, the non-pediatrician among the group.
And in fact, in this paper, which ended up becoming so controversial, in part, as I understand it, in reading the reports from all sides, in part because it was cast as a research paper and as if you were actually suggesting the causality rather than a case study in which you were suggesting, let's look to see if there's causality. But as I understand it, you were actually primarily the point person, the information, the clinical data and information that was in there in the case studies had actually been put together and collated or promulgated by your colleagues who were actually seeing these children. And you were the one who kind of put it all together and wrapped it up and put the bow on it and submitted it for publication. Is that correct?
That's right. The parents first came to me because of my interest in the subject, and then I coordinated the research or the team that then investigated these children. So that was pediatric gastroenterologists, psychiatrists, neurologists, and so forth. And we got together as a collaborative team to decide what was in the best interest of these children, what needed to be done in order to establish precisely what was going on. It was a very exciting time and a very important time. And the key question that arose out of this was the role of the vaccine. And you were just talking about chickenpox. Well, if this disorder, if this bowel disease and the regression had occurred following natural chickenpox, then this fuss wouldn't have taken place. But because it occurred or appeared to occur following a vaccine, it was something that was beyond the pale. It couldn't be discussed. It was, how could you mention this? How could you call into question the safety of vaccines? Well, I'm not here to appease public health or to appease the pharmaceutical industry. I'm here to address the questions that the parents raise about their children. That is my duty as a doctor. That is my obligation, and that is what we were in the business of doing. And we did that quite appropriately, and as you say, it started a firestorm, particularly from those with an interest, either through policy or profit, in the outcome of the work.
Well, and let's talk about that interest, because one of the allegations that was leveled against you, and indeed, am I right in understanding, has the case for erasure of your license in Britain concluded now?
No, far from it. We are appealing the decision. The decision was an extraordinary one. It went completely contrary to the evidence that was presented, and we felt at the end of it that they had no case at all. Their case had been demolished, and yet they found all of us guilty on practically every charge, which was absurd. And so it is now being appealed in the appeal court, and that will take place hopefully later this year.
And so part of that case, alleged case, again, well, there it is a case, but it may or may not be accurate or against you, is that, as you mentioned, that the part of the reason for this firestorm is because you were calling into question not just the efficacy but actually the safety of these vaccines, and there are interests from every walk, really, the companies that make the immunizations, and then, of course, public health officials who indeed are trying to ensure the greatest good for the greatest number, let's assume that. So part of what they have leveled against you was that you were not forthcoming in an alleged link between you and a legal action and the legal agency that was in fact pursuing a case against the vaccine manufacturers on behalf of some families who felt that their children had been vaccine injured. And so they were saying that it was unethical because there was a conflict which you did not divulge, when in fact that case really had absolutely nothing to do with your putting this research or this clinical information together and submitting it to the Lancet. Is that right?
That's right. It was a very curious allegation, because my involvement in the litigation had been in the national newspapers long before the paper was ever published. It was widely known. It was known throughout the medical school. It was known to my colleagues. I discussed it with everybody. And it was, as I say, reported in the national newspapers. So the idea that it had not been disclosed is an utter nonsense. And the Lancet paper, the 12 children in the Lancet paper, came to us for clinical reasons. When they came to us, they were not involved in any litigation at all. And therefore, it would have been inappropriate to mention the litigation in the Lancet paper. And it was disclosed to the Lancet immediately after publication, and they took no action at all. It was of no interest to them. It only became of interest to them some years later, 6 years later, when the editor of the Lancet found himself under considerable pressure, his job under considerable pressure, for having published the paper in the first place. And all of a sudden, it became a problem. He declared there was a conflict of interest. In fact, that conflict of interest did not exist. I obeyed the Lancet's disclosure rules to the letter, and that is well described in the book, as you know.
And indeed, the Lancet actually changed their disclosure rules following this, didn't they?
That's right. The original rules were in the active active voice. It was up to me to decide what I considered to be a conflict. I thought very hard about it, and I did not disclose the litigation because it was not relevant to these 12 children. Since then, it's become the passive voice. In other words, what would someone else possibly perceive to be a conflict? Well, that's a huge issue. I mean, anyone could perceive anything they like. So the rules have certainly changed. And what was extraordinary is that I was judged under the 2010 rules, when in fact I obeyed the Lancet's rules of 1997 to the letter.
And so they basically, well, you know, here in the United States, we have a prohibition against ex post facto laws, and you may or may not there, I don't know, I profess I'm not that familiar with British law, but it would seem that that's exactly what they were trying to do with you, is they changed the rule about what sort of disclosure was required and then applied the new rule to you, and were really trying to sort of pillory you with that, despite the fact that you had followed the rule, as you say, to the letter under the old rule, which was the rule under which you were operating, because, you know, you may be getting things, but I doubt you're prescient. So I don't imagine you could have foreseen that in 2010 the rule would have been different.
Well, you're quite right, Anne, and that is one of the reasons for the appeal, because the law in England is the same as it is in the States. There's no post facto changing of the rule. So we are appealing this on as a matter of fact that they were wrong in their decision.
Now, Dr. Wake, so there are many, many interesting points that you raise in your book, and sadly we don't have time to go into them all, and I have to confess that being an attorney, which I hope you won't hold against me, I found a lot of the information having to do with the sort of the intricacies of the proceedings really very interesting, and again, we don't have time to go into all of them, but some of the things in particular that I found very interesting, just from a personal perspective, is I know that in one of your papers, and I don't know if it was in the original Lancet paper or not, you recommended it. And I hasten to add that in this paper, you did not even say, I believe that the measles, mumps, rubella, the MMR vaccine is causing autism. You never actually said that in the paper. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
You just said, let's see if there's a link, because this is too many children to be coincidence.
That's right. There was clearly a scare. Parents were frightened. They didn't like this vaccine. In fact, in England, two brands of the MMR had been withdrawn for safety reasons some years before, so the public had reasons to be scared of this vaccine, and now these children were presenting in increasing numbers with regressive autism and a catastrophic disorder, and so our job was to address those concerns.
Just to remind everyone, you can call in with your questions and comments. We do have some callers already lined up, but we'll take you all at 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6. You can send us a message on Twitter at Monday Radio. Email your comments to comments@mondaynightradio.com, or if you're in our chat room, as I see many, many of you are, and there are already questions coming that way, please feel free to yell out your questions in the chat room as well. So about that, what I was going to say is that you recommend, at least at the time, you recommended what's known as the monovalent version of these various immunizations. And that's something with which I'm familiar, because as we were looking to make the vaccine decisions for our son, and the MMR was coming up, and I was very concerned about what I perceived as there being at least a potential for there being some sort of a causal connection with injury. We asked our pediatrician if he would get the monovalent form of one of those three components for us, and he was all too happy to do it. And in the end, we ended up not coming in to use it, and he told us not to worry about it because many other parents were so interested to be able to have that available to them. And what I noted was that that was your recommendation as well. You were not saying don't get your children vaccinated. You were saying don't have them get this triple vaccine that's got three components, one of which may or may not be somehow linked to this, but have them one at a time. And the response by one of Britain's top immunization experts, Dr. Horton, was to say that it was not available as a monovalent form. Did I understand that correctly? Because even I know that it's available that way.
Well, you see, what's fascinating about this, Annie, the reason for my putting this position forward is that I'm for a vaccine safety first agenda that has put safety as the priority. And what I did before making that recommendation was to read every paper that had ever been published on the pre-licensing safety studies of measles, mumps, and rubella vaccines and the combination vaccine. And I wrote a 250-page report, which I offered to my colleagues to read. And I said, look, this paper is coming out in The Lancet. It will provoke a lot of media interest. I cannot, if asked the question, what would you do now as a parent, I cannot recommend the use of MMR because the safety studies are irrisory, and they are certainly far worse than the safety studies of the single vaccine. I wrote this to my colleagues in great detail, spelling out my position. So I gave them the option of not engaging with the media on this issue. And I did that, and I made that recommendation. The dean went forward and had a press briefing. He asked me the question, what would you recommend now? And I told people. And so there was full disclosure. And at that time, the single vaccines were available. What happened then, 6 months later, is the British government unilaterally withdrew the importation license for the single vaccines, thereby depriving parents of an option of how to protect their children from infectious disease. Now, these parents were genuinely concerned about the safety of MMR. So I said to them, why would you do this? If your primary concern is to protect children from infectious disease, why would you remove an option for concerned parents? And their response was, because if we allowed parents to continue with the single vaccines, then it would destroy our MMR program. In other words, they put the program, the protection of the program, before the protection of children, and that is reprehensible.
Well, you know, that is not at all surprising to me, and I will tell you why. Here in the U.S., one of the things that is routinely done to newborn infants before they even leave hospital is they are given a hepatitis B immunization. And I did not realize that was going to happen. And so our son had that, again, as a newborn infant. And when I found out during our first follow-up visit with the pediatrician, I was absolutely outraged. I was livid. And I asked our pediatrician, you know, why on earth are they giving a newborn an immunization against hepatitis? I said, I really don't think he's going to be engaging in unprotected sex or shooting up drugs till he's at least 5 years old. So why is a newborn? And our pediatrician said the reason is because they're a captive audience. When they're out there doing those risky behaviors is a time when they're probably not going to come back in and get the immunization. And so the answer was simply because they can. And to me, that's just absolutely outrageous. And so I'm not surprised to hear you say that. But it does make me very sad that, you know, again, there's always many sides to a story, but usually the personal side is not the one that's being presented and protected by either government or big business. And in this case, that's really a travesty.
Right,
I have some questions for you.
Sorry to interrupt.
Excuse
you. Hepatitis B is absolutely right. And you will know as a lawyer and a parent that, first of all, what were they doing in the first place, vaccinating your child without your permission? Where is the process of informed consent in all of this? That is in itself a disgrace. The second thing is we've just done a study on this issue in rhesus macaque monkeys, looking at the vaccine schedule in these animals, and we published a paper on the infant hepatitis B vaccine, the day one vaccine. And in writing that paper, we did a thorough literature search to look for safety studies of that policy, and there were none, none before it was licensed. And that is absolutely extraordinary, taking an infant on day one of life, despite their possibility that they're either premature or low birth weight, and giving them a dose of vaccine containing the mercury preservative thimerosal. And what we found in that study is that those animals who were vaccinated had a significant delay in survival reflexes, such as those associated with feeding, reflexes that are essential for the survival of these animals in the wild. And that was not seen in the animals that received a saline injection as control. So as early as day one, you appear to be provoking some form of serious brain injury in these young animals. And that policy was never tested before it was put into place. And that, to me, is absolutely extraordinary.
It's horrifying. It's absolutely horrifying. And you mentioned the control group, and this is a question that I had for you, and it doesn't really fit here, but I'm going to bring it up anyway, which is this. Of course, one of the charges that has been leveled against you, not in your formal proceeding, but in the popular press and in the medical press, is that you basically single-handedly have brought down the entire vaccine system and are responsible for reducing herd immunity. And, you know, I think you might have turned our waters green and global warming as well. But what I wonder is if it is true, and I have no reason to doubt that given our own experience, that parents are now making more thoughtful and educated choices, and so there is a reduction in the vaccinated population. Is it possible that you sort of unintentionally, or not you personally, but are creating that control group of children who have not been routinely vaccinated, particularly with the MMR, such that at some point in the not-too-distant future, it will be possible to actually look at the population of children who have not had the MMR and look at them against the ones who have to see whether there is an appreciable difference in the incidence of autism or related illnesses?
It's a very good question, and it's one which parents have been advocating for a long, long time, and which the authorities, the CDC, everybody else, has been very, very, very reluctant to do. They do not want to do that, what's called the vax-unvax study. It's absolutely essential, and it may be a shock to parents to realize that the short, medium, and long-term health outcomes of children who have been fully vaccinated have not been compared to those who are unvaccinated to see what the differences are. And we're hoping that for the future this will be done, and if it isn't done by federal money, it will be done by private money, because it's an absolutely essential part of the vaccine safety program, and it is impossible to pronounce vaccines safe without that study having been done.
Well, it seems to me that autism, there is no one that has ever suggested that autism is, for example, communicable, and there's no other causal link that I have seen that's been put forth that would suggest that, for example, it's a function of something in the environment only in industrialized nations. So what about, you know, the host of quote-unquote third world, lesser developed countries where they're not getting the MMR vaccine? What are we seeing there? Is autism a new world phenomena?
Yes, it seems to be, and the clues to that come from what are called migration phenomena, migration observations. The Somali population are a classic example. In Somalia, there is no word for autism. It seems to be non-existent. And it's not that they don't know about it. It's not that they are not aware from extended family living in this country about autism. There is apparently no autism in Somalia. Yet when the Somalis come to either Sweden, the UK, or to the US, then they have an alarming rate of autism. Up to 1 in 28 children among Somali families have autism. And that is extraordinary for a disorder, which when I was at medical school was maybe 2 to 3 in 10,000 children. So rare we didn't even learn about it at medical school. Then 1 in 28 children is an extraordinary level. So what is it? There's a clue here. What is it about the environment in Somalia that is so markedly different from the environment in Minnesota, where there is a large population of Somalis? And is it something to do with what they are being exposed to in when they move to America? And the common denominator between Sweden, England, and the U.S. is certainly the vaccination policy. And the Somali parents say, this is what happened to my child. Now, what happens to the Somalis when they come is they not only get vaccinated before they leave Somalia, but they don't have records when they get to the U.S., so they get the whole lot again, all over again, and they get repeated vaccination far and above what a child in this country would normally receive. And so this may be unmasking a particular risk in that population leading to this alarming rate of disorder.
That's interesting, in as much as I've always been sort of the opinion, and of course this is a lay opinion, that there's probably several factors. And my thought is, and I'm sure that you know, much more aware people than I have had these thoughts, is that perhaps there are children who, through some environmental or genetic factor, tend to be more sensitive and prone, sort of, you know, are already predisposed to developing autism or regressive autism, and that for those children, the vaccine serves as a catalyst. And that would seem to sort of go along with what you've just described for these Somalis.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, and there's now data emerging on this. For example, just today I was reading papers from the Mayo Clinic talking about the the genetic background to our immune system control that makes us respond differently to the same vaccine, to measles vaccines. And so different people, one size does not fit all. Some families may respond in one way to the measles vaccine, whereas some other families respond in an entirely different way. And so there's the beginning of the problem, I think, and that is the genetic background. And then we have things like the mercury preservative in the vaccines and the aluminum adjuvant, which is put in there to promote the immune system. And these things alter the immune system, they poison the immune system, and then you give a child who has a potentially poisoned immune system a live viral vaccine, a triple vaccine, or now the quadruple vaccine with the chickenpox in there as well, and the immune system just puts up its hands and says, I don't understand this, I don't get it, and the child regresses. So I think you're absolutely right. It's multifactorial. It's all of these things coming together to put a child at major risk.
And, well, first I have to ask you, do you think the reason that they have added the chickenpox in with the MMR to make the MMRP at some point, every letter in the alphabet's going to be in there, do you think it's because there are so many parents like us who are choosing to not have it, and so, you know, they have to find another way to make sure we take our chickenpox vaccine?
Well, the understanding that I have of the situation is that the introduction of the chickenpox vaccine was entirely commercial. It was done, the original advertising, again, as I understand it, was that it wasn't done for the health of the child, but it was done to keep the mother in the workplace. You know, the chickenpox kept the mother at home looking after her sick child for 3 days. God forbid that a mother should look after her sick child. And so that was the imperative for introducing the vaccine in the first place. And I think someone must have told them along the way that that was not terribly good public relations, and therefore they changed to chickenpox, more serious than you think. Now, chickenpox is a mild disease in children. It really is a mild disease in all but a tiny proportion of children who might merit a vaccination. But that is it. And so to introduce it on a mass level and to combine it with three other live viral vaccines is extraordinary, and it brings into play something about which I'm particularly concerned, and that was the finding that when you compare children getting the MMR vaccine with the chickenpox vaccine given separately to those who are given the four vaccines in one shot, then it doubles the rate of seizures in those children, giving them all four vaccines in the same shot. And it just goes to show that when you add these live viral vaccines together, you produce unintended adverse consequences.
Let's go to some questions, and our questions seem mostly to be coming in over our chat line, which is absolutely fine. We have a caller, or a chatter, if you will, from Australia. In fact, she says, hi, Dr. Wakefield, I'm from Australia. The decision and your treatment you're getting from my perspective has been disgusting. My daughter is 13 months old, and we have been concerned about getting the MMR vaccine for us. She is only 7.8 kilograms, and we are concerned how there appears to be this large link with autism, with the vaccine being a one-for-all and not ratioed to weight. She's wondering, did you find any increase in autism in lower-weight children? And she also wanted to add that they don't have the option of the monovalent vaccine other than rubella, and that the vaccine they're using definitely is a live strain of the MMR.
Very, very important question. The answer is the only evidence that we have that would support that at this stage is from the primate study, suggesting that low birth weight infants are more susceptible to the adverse outcomes from the hepatitis B vaccine, than those of normal birth weight. But beyond that, we do not have further evidence, but it's a question that is clearly relevant and one that needs to be asked. What is interesting, and this may be relevant indirectly, is that there you've heard, I'm sure, that people going out there saying there are thousands of studies that show there's no link. Well, there aren't, actually. There aren't. And when you look at the studies of MMR and autism, there is clear evidence that children who get the vaccine at a younger age appear to be at a greater risk. So that may be related to their weight at that time. It may be related to the maturity of their immune system. We don't know. But that may go some way to addressing the question that this lady raises.
Now, I actually have a question that harks back to your gastroenterological, pardon me while I mangle that word, background with respect to this. And that is, you know, there are many infants who here in the States, we call it the witching hour, that there are many infants who sort of have, what was the old term for, you know, when they would have tummy troubles, in like very young infants, and they would scream and it would happen every single night. And do you know the phenomena of which I'm speaking? I'm trying to remember now what the old style term for that was, and I just can't, for that terrible tummy trouble every single night in newborns. And after a few weeks, that goes away, and then they're able to settle down in the evening. But what I'm wondering is, my son, in fact, had that. And so there was an evening, it would always sit around like 6 p.m., and for 2 hours, he would just clearly be in great gastrointestinal distress. And, you know, we had to do all sorts of things to get him calmed and to make him feel better. And I'm wondering if you have seen a pattern. Oh, and thank you. One of our chatters has just put that word in my head, colic, the colicky infant. Thank you, Christine. And so what I'm wondering is, have you seen any evidence? I'm wondering if infants, newborns who have that colicky sort of a syndrome tend to also be the children who have other GI problems such as you've seen, and if maybe that might mean that somehow they are already overly sensitive and more likely to run into problems with the vaccine. I know that your area of what you were researching or what you were seeing had to do with the stomach and the GI tract, and I think you found measles virus within the tract of the children who you biopsied. And please, again, correct me if I have any of this wrong, because I'm not a doctor.
Right. Well, it is interesting. We do see a very high proportion of children in the clinic who have regressive autism with gastrointestinal problems who have this early history of colic, of cow's milk intolerance, of reflux, of heartburn, waking, screaming. So they are very common, but it has never been subjected to a systematic analysis with a control group. So are these symptoms more common in our population of children with autism compared with neurodevelopmentally normal children? We don't know. All we can say is that they are alarmingly common. One of the fascinating things, and one of the things that always perplexes people, is, well, what is the link between the bowel and the brain? And one of the models that I use to try to explain this is alcohol. Alcohol is a neurotoxin. It's taken in through the gut, but it gets through the intestine in a very short time. It affects the brain. And when you put it that way, people start to get the idea that something, a toxin, a poison, or something from the immune system coming from the intestine that may be damaged can have an impact upon the brain. And if it's impacting the developing brain, the rapidly developing brain of an infant, then can it have an injurious effect that is lasting? And it's a very interesting possibility, and one that is part of what we're exploring at the moment, because there's no doubt that you put children on special exclusion diets, particularly those excluding wheat and milk, and not only do their intestinal symptoms improve, but their behaviors improve as well. So there is a great deal of room for exploration in this, and importantly, ways of ameliorating the symptoms of autism by intervening in such things as diet.
Well, now that raises an interesting question. I am a huge proponent of breast milk for babies, and in fact, many years ago, I spearheaded a milk drive which essentially was credited with helping to save the life of a young infant who had been adopted, and the mother couldn't nurse her, and she couldn't keep anything else down, and she was 8 months old and weighed 8 pounds. It was horrific. In any event, so I have seen the healing properties of breast milk. And I'm wondering, for these children that you were just describing, has there ever been the thought, or has anyone ever tried, of course, of actually going to a milk bank and having them drink human breast milk? And has that made a difference?
Yes. No, they haven't. And again, you raise so many important points. Breast milk can, I'm sure, be advantageous. The caveat is that things like casein, gluten, the things, the potential toxins that may be affecting these children are present in the mother's diet, and they get into the breast milk. So even though the infant themselves may be on an exclusion diet, those toxins or potential toxins may be coming through the breast milk. So in those circumstances, it would be important for the mother also to be excluding those things from her diet.
Mm-hmm.
So we have parents who believe their children are on a casein-free diet, but the mother is drinking cow's milk, and so these proteins that seem to be provocative are getting in. And so with that caveat in mind, otherwise I'm an enormous proponent of breast milk, because it contains things far beyond just the food substances. It contains agents or chemicals which are healing to the inflamed intestine as well.
And that was my thought. And, of course, it also carries with it all the immunities that, well, particularly if it's, you know, got some colostrum in it as well. We have another question from the chat line, but first let me remind people that you can certainly ask questions through the chat line, and you will find that just by going to the website at blogtalkradio.com/Monday Night Radio. And you can also call in at 866-MONDAY-6. That's 866-MONDAY-6. If you're listening from outside the U.S. and you can't call a toll-free number, we invite you to Skype us. You can Skype in, and you do not need to have Skype out, which is the paid system. You can do it for free by going to the website and just clicking on the Skype link. You can send us a message by Twitter at Monday Radio, and you can email us your comments at comments@MondayNightRadio.com. And Dr. Wakefield, one of our people in our chat room has a question. She says she's still confused as to why a triple vaccine is more dangerous than getting the immunization separately. She says it seems that more shots seem worse than getting just one.
Yes, and I believe that the reason for this goes back to the phenomenon of viral interference. Now, in 1969, in this country, in the U.S., when they first put these vaccines together, they found that they interfered with each other. The live viruses interfered with the immune response. And that meant that what they had to do was to adjust the amount of virus in each of the components in the vaccine to get the same immune response. They considered that to be an irritation, that interference phenomenon. The implications for safety seem to have been completely ignored. But there was something clearly very, very complex going on between these three viruses in the mix that were not the same as just 1 and 1 and 1 equal 3. They don't. They equal something very different. And this, again, is exemplified by the fact that when you put four viruses in together, measles, mumps, rubella, and chickenpox, you double the rate of seizures. So you're producing some effect that is unintended and unexpected. And this is because viruses are highly complex agents that deserve the greatest of respect, and it's not simply the same as just putting three ingredients together in a recipe and expecting them to behave like the individual components.
And with respect to that also, I think it's – well, let me ask you it this way. What would you recommend in your experience would be the – period of time between those monovalent immunizations? So in other words, to speak also to the question, it's not that you are getting all three at the same time but from separate hypodermic needles. It's that you are having them spread out over a period of time. And is there sort of a recommended period of time between which you should get each single vaccine?
Well, no work has been done on this. The closest we've come is that some years ago we published a study looking at the risk of whether, as an infant, you had suffered measles and mumps together in the same year as the natural infection. And we found that if you had experienced them together in the same year, then your risk of intestinal inflammation, Crohn's and colitis, went up substantially. And so we believe that this is related to some interference phenomenon between the viruses. So measles, I think you can make a very good case for children being protected against measles, and that is the virus, the vaccine that I would recommend first. Mumps, I have to say, I could not recommend at all. I think mumps is actually a dangerous vaccine, and I'll explain why. But mumps, again, was introduced for commercial reasons and not necessary for the well-being of children. And this goes back to a study done by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in this country when the vaccine was first mooted, it was first put forward. And the CDC said, we don't need this vaccine, we've done a study, mumps is a trivial disease in children, we don't need it. And yet somehow, for commercial reasons, it found its way into the marketplace and onto the schedule. Now, mumps in children is a trivial disease. Mumps in post-pubertal males in particular is not a trivial disease and can lead to testicular inflammation and sterility. Now, mumps is a dangerous vaccine because it doesn't work. It either doesn't protect enough individuals in the first instance, or the immunity that it produces wanes very, very quickly. And the problem with that is it pushes up the age when you are susceptible to mumps to those post-pubertal years. And therefore, it has made mumps a more dangerous disease. I hope that makes sense, but by increasing the age at which you are susceptible to mumps, because the vaccine has not worked properly, then you become susceptible to mumps when you're post-pubertal and you have a greater risk of these complications.
That makes perfect sense. Because what you're saying is, as we know, there are many vaccines which do not confer, in fact, a lifetime immunity. In fact, more and more the recommendation is for boosters even through adulthood. And so what you're saying is that the mumps vaccine may wear off at exactly the worst time for a person in their life to get mumps, which would be, after they've hit puberty. Whereas if they did not have the vaccine, as indeed we did not as children, you would just get a horrible case of a sore throat and get to eat lots of ice cream as a young child, which may not be fun, but is better than being sterile.
That's right. And then the response has been, well, give more vaccines. But the boosters don't work,
right.
And the boosted immunity drops off very quickly, and it becomes, if you like, a paycheck for the pharmaceutical industry. You just give more and more and more vaccines, but they do not work, and that is not the answer. And what you have is a population that it becomes dependent on this this wheel of taking vaccines. They're on the treadmill, and they're never going to get off. And there is a real problem with that, because no one has ever done the safety studies of giving more than one MMR vaccine.
Right. You're listening to Dr. Andrew Wakefield on Monday Night Radio. You can call in and ask a question at 866-MONDAY-6. Send us an email at comments@mondaynightradio.com or send us a tweet on Twitter at Monday Radio. One of our chatters in the chat room asks, would you please explain about the transfer factor for measles that you developed? Is it being used? It seems like it would have great potential. In the book Breakthrough by Suzanne Summers, there's a doctor talking about transfer factors for viruses as being the up-and-coming thing. Now, I confess I am not familiar with what she's talking about, so I hope you are.
Yes. Transfer factor, this is something that I was accused of producing a competitive vaccine to MMR. That is absolutely not the case, and it never was such a thing. Transfer factor is a naturally occurring substance. And it's been extensively studied, but it's kind of fallen out of fashion now for some reason. But transfer factor is something that appears to be produced by immune cells in response to a specific infection. So if you get measles, you produce a measles-specific transfer factor. And it was called transfer factor because when you took that substance and you gave it to someone else who'd never had measles, or in this case tuberculosis, then they appeared to be protected against it. And so that was the name, that's where transfer factor came on. It transferred immunity from one to the other. And it did so in a way that didn't prevent you getting infected, but helped you deal with the infection once you got it. And so here we had a group of children who appeared to have persistence of measles in their diseased intestine. So was it possible that by giving a measles-specific transfer factor, we could boost their own immunity to get rid of that virus and thereby potentially get rid of the disease? That was the hope. Now, sadly, we tried to raise money to do a clinical trial, but we were unable to raise sufficient funds to do it. And so we were never able to answer that particular question. But it remains something of great interest to me. As I say, it's rather fallen from favor amongst the immunology community. But there are people out there producing it, and you can get it, for example, through the Internet. It's classed as a nutritional supplement, and indeed that is what it is. But has it been tested out properly in children with autism in formal clinical trials? No, I don't believe so.
So you can get it on the internet as a nutritional supplement, but you would need to get it. Are they marketing measles-specific transfer factor and mumps-specific transfer factor and the like? You have to get a different one for each potential disease, right?
You can get specific transfer factors for specific agents. Now, I haven't looked at this on the internet for a long time, but if anyone is interested, it's an easy thing to do, and just type in transfer factor or measles and transfer factor, and the answer will be there.
Well, and that brings up actually something that is related to another question that I had, which is that specifically with the measles component of the vaccine and measles in the wild as well, and this harks back, I think, to the person to whom you refer as George, although he eventually let himself known to be Dr. Alistair Thores, or Thores, who came from Canada, where as a public health official they had banned one of the strains of, was it the mumps or the measles strain, but a particular strain because it was absolutely injuring children. And again, you can certainly explain that better than I, but what it brought to mind to me was that there are different strains of these viruses that are being used in the various vaccine preparations. And it's important to understand, I think, that there are different strains, so for example, of measles in the various vaccines. And so how that relates to my question about the transfer factor is, does that mean that you not only need to have a measles-specific transfer factor, but one that is specific to the strain of measles to which you might be exposed?
Again, an important question.
That was very convoluted. Did that make sense?
That makes sense. Is there a need for a strain-specific transfer factor for different strains of measles, for example? I think it likely that if transfer factor exists and works, it will work across a broad spectrum, and so I suspect that one would treat most. Not to say that it would treat all, but it would treat most, and therefore one wouldn't need to get overly complex about it. But the point you raise, actually, and if I might dwell on this just for a second, because this is,
sure. In
fact, the reason for why the government had to silence me in the first place was just this Canadian issue. The whistleblower, George, who came to me after I'd been involved in this for a year or two, and I couldn't understand why the medical school was so adamant that I should not do this vaccine safety research. It seemed to me obvious, in light of the parents' concerns and in light of the fact that the safety studies had not been done, that it should be done. And the medical school came under pressure, and I didn't know this at the time, from the British government. Members of the British government contacted the dean of the medical school and urged him to stop the vaccine safety research that was part of the legal aid program. And they were eventually successful in doing that. And I discovered some years later that this was because in the late 80s, when they introduced MMR in the UK, they introduced a brand of the MMR which was known to be dangerous. In the same month that it was licensed in the UK, it had been withdrawn in Canada because it was causing meningitis in children. Now, its name changed, not surprisingly, from Trivirix in Canada to Fluzarix in the UK, but it was the identical vaccine. And they brought in this doctor, Dr. Torres, the whistleblower, from Canada to advise them on the introduction of the vaccine. And he said, do not do it. Do not introduce this vaccine because it's causing meningitis and children are being harmed. And they ignored him. They completely ignored him. Why? Because it was cheaper. They opted for a cheaper vaccine rather than protect the well-being of children. And they got themselves into a bit of a mess because Glaxo, or SmithKline Beecham, as they were at the time, I gather from the whistleblower, were very unhappy about bringing in this vaccine because they faced potential liability. And so in a deal, which is very, very dubious, the British government appear to have underwritten the liability of that pharmaceutical company in order to get that vaccine on the market. And 4 years later, after its introduction, it had to be hurriedly withdrawn because it was causing unacceptably high levels of meningitis in children. And so Dr. Torres' concerns that were born out of his experience in Canada and experiences elsewhere in Japan and Australia, meant that that vaccine should never, ever have been produced. And because they knew that I had this information, they had to try and silence me. And that's why this witch hunt has come about. It will be exposed. It will be revealed. It's not conspiracy theory. It's simple fact of matter of fact. And it will come out. So that really is one of the more important parts of the story and why parents and others who are interested in this issue need to read the book and understand the background to this and what actually happened, and not this elaborate, expensive, and ultimately highly deceitful public relations exercise that has been conducted, where the parents and the children have been the main victims.
Doctor, we have Laura Chalik in the chat room. She says she's someone who is very, very thankful for you, and she thanks you every day for being the voice of families with vaccine-injured children. And she has a question, which is, have you ever heard of a young child getting orchitis after the MMR?
It has been reported. I have not seen it personally, but it is. There are cases in the medical literature of that happening, yes. And thank you, Laura. I know Laura.
And we have just a couple of minutes left, and we have a couple of more questions coming through the chat room. And one is, if you were able to say, would you recommend the Rubellin vaccine at this point?
So I think you can make a very, very good case for the use of the rubella vaccine. There's no doubt there's been a dramatic decline in congenital rubella syndrome following the introduction of this vaccine, and certainly rubella, congenital rubella, is a cause of autism, and so it may be that this vaccine is actually helping protect against autism caused by congenital rubella syndrome, so yes.
And that actually leads very nicely into the next question from the chat room from another one of our chatters, which is, did any of your studies include children with classic autism as well and not just regressive? She's wondering if the effects of vaccines on children with classic autism. Now, I confess, I'm only inferring that classic autism is one that they have from early on, and regressive is one where they sort of suddenly it comes on later and they regress, but that's just a wild interpretation. I don't know if that's accurate, so perhaps you could tell us the difference.
No, you've hit the nail on the head. Classical autism, as supposedly described by Leo Kanner in 43, is of early onset. Children who never acquire skills, never engage, never have eye contact, are often described as very quiet babies who never cause any trouble, compared with the type of autism that we are seeing and are seeing with an increasing frequency now, and that is of the child who develops normally to 12, 13, 14, 15 months and then loses skills. Have we seen children in the clinic with classical autism? Yes, we have. And in my experience, they tend not to have the disorder that we've described, but they do have a high frequency of things like esophagitis that you get from reflux, and so there are gastrointestinal problems in these children, but they do not seem to be typical of the pathology that we see in the children with the more aggressive forms of autism.
We have only a minute and a half left. And so I want to say, first of all, that it has been an absolute treat having you on the show. I am very grateful for you taking your time out of your busy schedule. And I know part of that schedule includes you being here in Boulder on Wednesday evening at a talk, which I intend to attend. So I will look forward to that. And I believe that's at our Boulder Public Library for local Boulder people who are listening. And also I would urge everyone who has any questions, or even if you don't, to get the doctor's book. It's called Callous Disregard. It's available from Amazon. It's an absolutely fascinating read. And is there anything else that you would like to say before we let you go?
Well, you can also get the book at the website, which is callous-disregard.com. And if you buy it there, then the proceeds will go to further autism research. So that is an alternative to buying the book. But it is worth reading, at least in terms of understanding what happens to doctors who really do what their conscience tells them to do rather than acting in the interest of policy and profit. If you cross that Rubicon, if you step out of line, then this is what happens. And I the truth is, and it's been a great privilege looking after these children and helping their families, and I wouldn't change anything at all. It's just a fact of life that if you do this, then you are going to be ostracized and criticized. But that is not a reason not to do it. I think that medicine needs to live up to its responsibilities to the patients and to the parents, and to move away from this.
Oh, yes. You know, I certainly remember, I think, sending an email to your PR person.
Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Again, I really, really appreciate it. It's been wonderful having you. And I'll see you Wednesday.
I look forward to seeing you, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Doctor.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That was the first part of our Monday night show. Stay tuned now as we talk with survivors of breast cancer. And you will need to call back in as we recycle the switchboard.